Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners, or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard They Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of They Had to Go Out podcast. Thank you guys for listening today. Thanks for downloading, subscribing, sharing, liking, doing all that social media stuff that gets the word out about the show and the National Coast Guard Museum. We really appreciate it. Hope you continue to do it. Continue to leave those 5-star reviews and give us great feedback and refer us to some truly epic guests. And one of which we have on today. So another guest referred to us, kind of like Darryl O'Malley, by Mr. Paul Sweeney. On the phone today, we've got Mr. Jim Rambus. And actually, I should rephrase that. We have Senior Chief Bosun Mate Jim Rambus, retired. Senior Chief Rambus, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me, Bill.
Well, Senior, we'll start the show by asking you the question that we ask all of our guests. What serves your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story or stories?
Well, Phil, I don't want to call it a sea story, but the most scary I ever had was making a logistic run to the offshore lights on the Lake Huron side. At the time, I was on Mackinac Island, and there was three of us, bosun's mates, that we took turns making the log runs. Well, it was my turn for the log run that week. Those log runs were weekly. They changed personnel. Most of them would stay out. I think it was 3 weeks out and 1 week off. Anyways, we'd pick up the personnel in Sheboygan and with their supplies and transport them to the lights.
What did they, Jim, when they went to leave for the lighthouse for a 3-week stint, is everybody just carrying a sea bag or what are these guys packing?
No, Phil, they would, you would spend 3 weeks on the light and then you had a week off. And that was referred to as compensatory absence. It didn't count against your leave.
Okay.
So you got a week off after spending 28 days on the light.
Okay, and then what did they take out there? I mean, did they carry their sea bag with them? Did they just have books in it at the time? I mean, what did you guys generally haul out there for them?
Well, it was their food and personnel themselves. Like we'd take one person back to Po Reef, one would come off. The one that was, yeah, had his 28 days would come off.
Right, one for one swap. Right.
One for one swap, yep. Plus the food.
Right. And then the fuel, too. I'm guessing you guys had to take fuel?
Tenders usually fueled the light stations. Okay. They bring their potable water out, and they would do that usually in the spring before they commission. they top off their fuel tanks for to run the generators, and also top off their potable water.
And what was the general attitude of guys going to the lighthouses? Was that a preferred duty? Was that something that people kind of fought a little bit or didn't want to do? How did they take that?
No, that lighthouse duty was semi-isolated. You know, like Pole Reef, the one I was on, it was 64 by 64 feet. You had no place to go. There'd be days that the foghorn would be sounding for 1 or 2 days sometimes. And it was a two-tone diaphragm that we had on the at Pole Reef. I don't know if you've ever heard a two-tone diaphragm, but, you know, high and low.
Right.
And it could be heard for miles. You know, you can imagine how it was on the light station.
Oh, yeah. I can't. Oh. Did you guys have to wear earplugs or just stomach it and go on?
This is before earplugs.
Oh, no.
Yeah, we didn't have earplugs back then.
Just your fingers or some grass or something, huh?
No, we didn't have them on the light ship either.
Oh.
So, well, anyways, to continue here, made the stop at Pole Reef, disembarked the personnel that were going on the light and took the people that were going ashore. The next stop was Spectacle Reef. And I don't want to say there was a bad sea running, but it was sloppy. So we got to Spectacle Reef, and the person that we were dropping off had a few cocktails before he boarded the boat. And he was standing on the bow. I says, I'm only going to make one pass here. If you don't get off, I says, we're going to Martin's Reef, which was the next light station. So I got the bow into the ladder for him to jump off. He turned around to wave, and I backed hard. And when I backed hard, the stern of the 40 filled with water, and I almost lost it at that point. I got the boat turned around and back into the seas, and a lot of the water bailed out, and I just kept her into the seas until most of the water was out, and then the rest of the water bailed out through the scupplers. Fortunately, the engine hatches were dogged down, and there was no water got into the bilge, and also the cabin door was closed, so no water got into the forward cabin. At that time, I radioed the station, and Chief Henley, who was the officer in charge, I told him what had happened. I says, I'm a little nervous here. I says, I'd like to return the station. He says, continue on your log run. So that was a big change. I think if I would have returned, I'd probably been scared for a long time, but as it was, I finished my log run. I was a nervous wreck for a few days, but I got over it because I had, like, I think I had, with my crew, I had six people on the boat, plus myself, and I almost lost my boat.
Yeah, and like when you were making the run where you did almost swamp, what was the shoreline like? I mean, how was it? How hairy was it to get guys from the boat to shore there?
Well, the log run usually took on the Lake Huron side, it'd take us about 3 hours. When I was doing log runs from out of Charlevoix Station, it was a 110-mile trip. And with the 44 or the 36, it would take a little over 12 hours. And with the 40 boat, just a little over 10 hours. And, you know, we made the decision what boat to take when we got underway, depending on what conditions the lights were reporting. And usually the lights were, they'd say favorable landing conditions on the north side, and Maybe.
Without fail, but, right? I bet. Yeah, without fail. Favorable landing conditions. Come on out.
I mean, you know, and you can't blame them. I spent my time on the lighthouse, and you do fib a little bit because you want to get off, especially if it's your turn. You know, you want to get off that light and get your week off. So a lot of times it got a little hairy, but the worst experience I had was at Spectacle Reef, which was on the Lake Huron side. And I got over it eventually. And, you know, after making first class and, from then on, I was pretty much in an officer in charge position as a first class and as a chief. So other than my search and rescue coordinator positions, I was mostly in charge. So I just did the training and kept everything shipshape at my units.
And so did you carry that lesson forward that you're, I guess it was a lesson. It could have been a lot of different things, but we'll call it a lesson where your chief said, you know, during that incident when you wanted to come back and he said, stay out and finish the log run. Did you carry that forward in your own commands?
In a sense, I did. You know, there was times that my small boats had to, you know, respond to a case, and I had to make the decision whether I felt that the coxswain was qualified or if I needed help from the group. Back then, we worked close with the with our group commanders, and, you know, there'd be times that maybe I needed an 82-footer instead of sending out the 40 boat. And we worked closely with the group. So if we needed something, or if we needed an aircraft, we'd work through the group. But I would hesitate. I always hesitated to really send any of my personnel under conditions that I felt they possibly couldn't handle.
Right. Because you'd seen it firsthand.
I did.
Yeah. It's funny, you know, I'm thinking back to, anybody that drives boats for a living, it's never the most dramatic search and rescue case or law enforcement case that usually proves you're a good boat driver or otherwise tells you, you know, the ocean tells you that you have a lot to learn. It's always something simple, it seems, like trying to get somebody from shore to the lighthouse or from the boat to the lighthouse. And then all of a sudden the ocean tells you, I'm still the big kid on the block, I guess.
Yeah. Well, later on in our discussion here, I'm going to mention Mackinac Island again. And the officer in charge, you know, that told me to come back, it was his turn for a log run. I don't know if I had mentioned this to you before. And this was for the closing of the light stations for the season. So he started out at Pole Reef, the chief did, again, because it was his turn for the log run. And he picked up the personnel off of and all their gear at Pole Reef. They secured everything. And then the next light station was Spectacle Reef. Got all personnel off of that. His next stop was Martin's Reef. And he got the personnel off of there. He lost an engine, and he started icing up pretty bad. And those 40 boats had these URC-7 radios. And if someone sneezed or there was a thunder squall or anything happened, like icing, you lost communications. So now the station, I was back at the station. We had no communications with the 40 boat. All the light stations were closed, so we couldn't call any of the light stations to see where the 40 boat was. So now they were well overdue. The group called Traverse City Air Station, and they launched an aircraft to go looking for him. Meantime, the chief, who had come to Station Mackinac Island from Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, he was in charge of a buoy boat up there, and he had set these buoys going to this Upper Peninsula town called Cedarville. While the buoys had already been hauled, and somehow he managed to navigate and get into Cedarville. He seen lights on a dock that he was familiar with. He pulled into the lights, and as it was, the person that owned the dock and the house was a retired captain from the Coast Guard. And the captain said, "What's going on?" And he said, "Well, we lost an engine, lost communications. Can we call the station, let them know we're here and we're safe?" And the captain brought the whole crew in the house. His wife fed them, and they called the sheriff's department, and the sheriff come and picked up the guys and took them all to some of the local motels up there. Meantime, the chief had called the station, said, we're fine. We have an engine that's down. The engine men are working on the engine, and we'll call before we get underway in the morning. So anyways, the engine men worked on the boat all night. They finally got the engine going again. Rex, who was the chief on there, called and said, we're underway. We're on the way back. The wind's blowing pretty good out of the northwest. He says, we're going to be icing pretty bad. And I didn't know what to say at that time. I says, Rex, you sure you want to, you know, take the chance of coming right now? He says, yeah, we'll make it fine. So I says, all right, I'm going to come out with a 36 and meet you. So we had quite a bit of sea smoke that morning. And there was a freighter, one of the last freighters, coming out of St. Mary's River. They were heading for Chicago, and got a hold of the freighter and asked them to keep an eye out for the 40-footer, or if they could pick him up on the radar. Now, the 40 didn't have any communication, so we couldn't call him, couldn't talk to him. I hadn't even cleared the harbor out of from Mackinac Island, and I started icing. I lost my radio. Those URC radios, they were a piece of junk.
Truly junk, so, right? So that's two boats with radios down already.
Yeah. So anyways, my radio didn't go down till after I talked to the ship. I don't recall the name of the ship. But I could see it, but all I could see was a superstructure. And it was a sea smoke.
Right.
So anyways, and actually I could see the top, I could still see the top of Mackinac Island. So anyways, I called the ship and I said, do you have any targets? I says, are 40 footers out there somewhere? And he said, yeah, it was less than half a mile behind them. So anyways, I finally spotted the 40 boat. They spotted me. I turned around, they followed me back into the island. And Chief Henley, I want to say he was frozen to the wheel. I mean, they had to take ball bats and break the ice off of him. I don't know how he even docked that boat, that 40 boat. The boat was, I don't even know how the boat was floating. It had so much ice on it. But anyways, we got him into the station, and the group commander was already on the phone wanting to know what the hell was going on. He was chewing out Rex. Poor chief, you know, he could hardly talk. He was shivering, and he was in a state of hypothermia. And at that time, we'd never heard of hypothermia. You know, this, I don't want to say this was routine, but there was many a case up in the northern lakes where we would go out in these open construction boats. And, you know, to have a little ice on our hoods and watch caps was you know, it was, I don't want to say routine, but when you're operating an open boat, and even if there's only a 2 foot chop and you're getting a spray, everything's freezing. So, anyways, we didn't know nothing about hypothermia. And as it is, right now, I believe Chief Henley is, or Senior Chief Henley is still suffering from that experience. We know he had frostbite and a lot of other medical conditions as a result of that log run. Actually, I spoke with him not too long ago. I had just sent in a nomination as Chief Henley or Senior Chief Henley being one of the great chiefs of the Coast Guard. As you probably know, we have our 100th anniversary coming up, 100 years of chiefs. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Never heard of it, Jim. But, I mean, get out of here. Come on. Everybody knows it's the centennial year of the chief. Are they better, right?
Well, yeah.
Come on. Yeah, I mean, you're more important than that, man. You started a legacy. People know that one.
Yeah, okay. I don't know what I was thinking.
Yeah, all right. Well, at least we corrected that.
Okay, so anyways, from Mackinac Island, by the way, Mackinac Island was, I don't want to say a fun station, but it was a unique station. There was no automobiles allowed on the island. It was all horse and buggy or a bicycle. That's how you got around. The governor of Michigan, he had his summer retreat on the island. And when he'd, we would always transport him. There was a state trooper who was his bodyguard that lived on the island in the summertime. But he hung out at the station all the time. And when the governor would come up with some of his politicians, he'd come up sometimes with senators and all that. We had to be on our toes all the time because we didn't know until the trooper came down and said the governor's going to be in Mackinac City in a couple hours. He's going to need a ride over. But anyway, you didn't know who was going to be with him. Sometimes it'd be senators, other governors. So we used to have to keep our boats looking sharp and keep the our colors flying as Coast Guardsmen.
So did you ride a horse and buggy into work? I mean, you guys had to park on one side of the island, then
That was another unit that was considered semi-isolated, and you'd spend your 28 days out there, and then you got a week off. Myself, I was single at the time, so most of the time I would stay on board and go on liberty, you know, or take off whenever I wanted to. During my week off. Actually, I had a part-time job as a bartender.
Nice. All right.
On the island. And, you know, sometimes I would decide to go to the mainland. And at the time, I had a 60 Corvette. And I kept it parked at the local radio station. They had a parking garage there. And what I'd do is... I always liked Charlevoix. I'd take a run, drive down to Charlevoix, and the chief was officer in charge of the station. He was a hell of a guy. He was a rebel. He was from down south somewhere, but really a nice guy. His name was Otis McKeithen, and he'd give me my own room on the station, and the galley was open to me. And, you know, I'd spend a week in Charlevoix and go and come as I pleased. And it was pretty nice.
Did you have to let him drive the car? Was that the deal?
Pardon?
Did you have to let him drive the car? No, that wasn't it?
Actually, I think one of the reasons Otis and I got along so well, he was building a hot rod in the boathouse.
Oh, okay. I knew there was something to that story. I knew there was something there.
Yeah, he was building himself a street rod, and we'd have to hide it every time there was an inspection.
he needed an accomplice. I like it. That's good.
He was a great guy, though. I'll never forget him. He treated me like I was his son. To let me stay on the station, and I had open galley. Really, I'd go out and have a few beers, come back to the station. Check out the fridge, see if there was anything good in there, and hit the rack. I didn't have to get up in the morning. I had my own room, actually. So that was pretty nice. So getting back to Mackinac Island, it was all horse and buggy. Again, we would transport the governor quite often. His wife, by the way, the governor at the time was George Romley, the father of Mitt Romney.
Okay.
I think everyone's heard about Mitt Romney.
I'm sure. I would think so. Anybody of voting age, at least, right?
Yeah. So anyways, Governor Romney was a hell of a guy. He just, he was like a crew member on the boat. And his wife occasionally would like to steer the boat. I remember one time we were coming back we had picked him up in Mackinac City, and we were going back to the island, and he had a couple other people or a couple other senators and their wives, and we were going back to the island, and Mrs. Romley came out and said, "Can I steer?" I said, "Sure." So we're heading back to the island. It was a little windy, but it wasn't rough or anything like that, and Governor Romley stuck his head out from the cabin. I can't remember her first name. He says, "We got a dinner engagement at the Grand Hotel this evening, and your hair is a mess." She says, "Don't worry about it."
She's having too much fun.
Yeah, he was a hell of a governor. I don't think his son was anything like he was. Yeah. You know, I guess he's still a state senator, isn't he?
I think Mitt Romney's a senator from Utah, I do believe.
Yeah, yeah.
I won't delve into politics on it, other than to confirm he's a senator and appreciate his service. Let's talk about, so at Mackinac, what kind of boats did you guys have? You said a 40 and a 36?
We had a 40 and a 36, and we got a new 44 while I was there.
Okay. Yeah. You're one of the, we were talking to Darryl O'Malley, who said the new 44 was the, I guess that was his own personal Corvette kind of, right? Same at the station when she was delivered.
Yeah. The, 44, I can't remember who brought her up from Baltimore. I think it was one of the BMs from, Charlevoix. But he brought it up to the station from Baltimore, and we kept the 44 and the 36 for a while. The 36 eventually went down to the group in Charlevoix, and we had the 44 and the 40.
Okay. Which was your favorite?
36.
Why the 36?
Well, I thought it was a better riding boat than the 44. The 44, to me, was a bathtub. And you were all over the place. Maybe the 44s were a little different on the lakes because we didn't have the long swells. You know, it was mostly the waves were a lot closer together. And I don't know, you got beat up in them.
Right.
And the 036, there was a heavy boat, had a bronze keel, and also had Manel sheathing on the bottom because they could break up to about 6 inches of ice.
Oh, really?
It was a heavy boat, and she'd just plow through the seas, where the 44, you were all over the place. I took some good rides on the log runs on the Lake Michigan side where You know, you get halfway, like I said, with the 44, it would take you almost 12 hours. It was 110 miles, I think, the log run from the station to the first light, which was Gray's Reef. The next light station was White Shoals, and the next one was Lansing Shoals. And that was over a 100-mile trip. It took almost 12 hours in the 44. The same if you did it in the 36. The 40, you were around 10 hours in making the trip.
Yeah, but, what was the top speed on the 40?
She turned around 2 grand.
Yeah.
Now, you know, both had 671 diesels in it. I think I'm trying to think of one of the fastest 40s we had was... trying to think of what station it was. One of the engine. Oh, I think it was at Point Alton. The engine there had put some big injectors in there, and I think we were getting 2150 out of both engines, you know, each engine. And that you're moving right along at 2150 and a 40-footer.
Yeah. Which is what, like 15 knots, 12 knots? What do you think?
Oh, no, no. It was in the 20s.
Oh, it was in the 20s. Okay. All right. Yeah. That's pretty good. That's faster than I thought. What about 36?
Oh, she'd do 9.
A slow boat to China?
But she'd do 9 when it was flat-ass calm, and she would do 9 if you had a 5-foot sea.
Yeah, that's a, you know, I've heard that from everybody that talks about 36. Yeah, just consistent, right, on the always with speed.
I really liked that boat, and you know, I had no problem handling it. It had a big rudder, and it was turning a pretty good size screw. And one of the first 36s I ran was in Group Detroit, and that had a Kermath in it, a gas engine. And I would not go aboard that boat until the engine started it, because it would spit and sputter and finally fire up. I was scared the damn thing was going to blow up. but they eventually put, I think there were 671s in all the 36s. And going back to Point Alton, did we go to Point Alton yet?
Nope. Let me ask you, I want to ask you another question real quick if I can, just because okay. I got your ear. So you were one of the only lightship sailors that we've had on, and probably one of very few that we've had on that's ever served time at a lighthouse. Can you take us through what was life on the lightship like?
Well, the lightship again was considered isolated duty. It was 28 days on, and you had a week off. I reported aboard the lightship. I believe it was in August. Of 54, I was only on there a week when we got hit by Hurricane Carol.
Oh, man.
I got introduced to my sea legs real quick.
I can imagine.
We had both mushroom anchors down, and we were each time a wave, a good-sized wave would come in, both anchors would lift off the bottom, and we drifted almost 5 miles off station. And while this was all going on, there was a pilot boat called the Roseway. It was a sailing vessel, a schooner. And they'd hang around with us, you know, in the area of the lightship, and when the ship was coming in, they'd put the pilot in a dory, and they would row to the ship, and they would board the ship. Well, the pilot boat, actually, we didn't have radar. All we had was a compass on the lightship. There was no radar. There was no nothing.
Pheromoner? Did you guys have a pheromoner, or did you have to use a lead line?
We used a lead line.
Yeah.
actually, with the small boats, we either used a lead line or a boat hook.
Oh, the boat hook. The tried and true. You can't go wrong with the boat hook.
I mean, you couldn't touch bottom with the boat hook. You had plenty of water.
Yeah, you're still floating. That's good.
That's all we had on the small boats, and even on the lightship, all we had was there was no radar. Had a compass, anemometer, and a barometer. we forecast our own weather.
Did you have that same crappy radio that was on the 40 and the 36?
You know, I'm trying to think of what we had for communications. I really don't remember. I have no idea.
What was your duty on there? So when you reported on board, you said within 2 weeks the hurricane came. Like, what did they have you doing?
I was a seaman apprentice.
Yeah, well, I mean, what did a seaman apprentice do in 54?
Well, with the bosun mate, we lashed down everything we could. The small boat that we had on there, the pulling boat, we just, you know, secured all the gear, made sure all the hatches were dogged down properly, and rowed her out.
Yeah. Were they panicked at all, like, when you started drifting station?
I was.
Yeah, well, I'm sure you were, but, did you hear anything from the more senior crew that they were going to fire up the engine and try and, you know, might need you?
The engines were running, and I thought at full speed ahead, but we were going the wrong way.
Oh, man. Yeah,
because I can't remember what we had for power, but I remember when we went, we were scheduled for dry dock the year I was on it, and on our way into Boston, I don't think we were making five miles an hour.
Yeah.
It took us quite a while to get into Boston, but, yeah, well, the bosun mate we had, the first class, he was on there getting his sea duty. So, and the chief, he was an old salt. You know, he'd spend most of his career at sea. And I remember being up on the bridge when he come up there. We were really taking a beat, and he come up there, and he was smoking this rotten pipe. I don't know what he had in there for tobacco, but it was bad. And I was sick anyways. I was seasick. But anyways, we survived the hurricane. When the next morning come around, we were, like I said, about 5 or 6 miles off station. We got the anchors back on board, and I'm trying to figure out how in the hell the chief ever got us back on station, because we're about 9 miles off of Point Allerton. I don't recall how he got us back on station.
Might have had to be towed, huh?
Well, no, we got underway, but I don't recall what we had to get our position.
Okay.
I don't know if he had a sexton or I was a seaman apprentice. I had no freaking clue.
He just eyeballed it.
I don't think he eyeballed it, because our position was chartered.
Right.
And I'll tell you, that was a scary duty. More than one lightship had been hit. And actually, the Nantucket was hit a couple times, I believe.
So when you got on there, Jim, you probably didn't know that, right? Being the seaman.
Oh, no.
Was that part of the lore that the crew told you? Like, hey, man, these things sink all the time?
Well, they don't sink all the time, but there had been collisions. Actually, while I was on the Boston lightship, in the heavy fog, some of these ships would—you could tell what color they were. That's how close they were.
Yeah, stop driving to the sound, guys! Don't drive to the sound.
Well, they home in on your radio beacon. We were putting out a signal. I can't remember what the our code was. I do remember the call signs of the lightship. It was Nan Nan Baker Charlie. But those ships were home right in, they come right in on our radio beacon. And like I said, the pilot boat was usually close by, and they put someone in, you know, they had communication. They put someone in the dory and rowed the pilot over to the ship so he could bring it into Boston Harbor.
Yeah, that'd be, I can imagine, like, the tales that were probably told on that boat, just to, especially when you guys, if you ever got news of one getting close, or even if you looked out on that foggy day and saw them.
Well, I remember a more McCormick line boat. I don't know what their cargo was, but he came as close as any ship I have ever seen come that close. I mean, he was tuned right into our radio beacon because he was heading right for us.
You guys yell at him, or how does
no
no?
we did, you know, we'd call on the radio saying, you know, a vessel approaching the Boston Light vessel.
Slow down and turn to port.
no, just we're here. We're on station. So
we're on station. Oh,
well,
man.
they should know, you know, where what our position was.
Right. No, I get it.
We were charted.
Yeah.
So.
It brings the reality of how dangerous that duty is. You're right. I mean, you got people homing right into you, and you never really think about it.
That was a navigation back then.
Right.
You know, that's how they navigated.
Well, how'd you keep yourself entertained on the light ship?
Oh, we had the John Wayne movies. They'd bring movies out to us sometimes, out of Boston. But they were the same ones. They'd go from the light ship maybe to 327. They made the rounds.
Right. Yeah.
But it was the same old movies. It seemed like after a couple months, the same ones would come back to you. We didn't have a choice, saying, "Oh, we'd like to watch this or we'd like to watch that." Whatever they dropped off to us.
Right. We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor. We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
There are 5 themed storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum.
And here's our favorite 5. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT. Want to check out is the Always Ready Collective, delivering art by and for daring fighters of the sea with their maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. Visit them on Facebook, Etsy, Instagram, and at alwaysreadycollective.com. Well, let's talk about your time. So when you made chief as a SAR controller at Group Woods Hole, and then you went to take your first command at Cape Cod Canal. Can you talk about that process? Because I'm just curious what it was like to make. Did you have to sit for a board to make officer in charge? Was it just an assignment you requested and they gave to you? How did that work?
Well, I didn't request the assignment. I was pretty happy as a SAR coordinator at Woods Hole. I don't want to get too much into this because I don't know what happened, but the officer in charge had been relieved by a warrant officer from the group.
Right.
Something happened. I don't know what happened. And the group commander, who's a captain, he says, "I want to send you up to the Cape Cod Canal. Do you think you can handle it?" I says, "Well, it's going to be my first command." He says, "Well, I have good faith in you." I says, "Okay." So that's how I got that first assignment.
And
there was no qualifications involved at the time. Later on, I did get certified as with officer in charge of ashore.
Okay.
I qualified as officer in charge ashore.
And was that a board?
I think it was, yeah. I really don't remember if there was a board that did boards back then. I know they did for a float. I don't know if they did for a shore.
Okay. I was just curious, just seeing how it was then. Well, how'd your first command go?
Well, I stepped into a mess. actually, Phil, believe it or not, I never, of the three units that I was in, SAR stations that I was in charge of, I never relieved the officer in charge. The officer in charge had already been relieved for, I don't know for what reasons.
Man, you were the pinch hitter.
Yeah, I felt like the cleanup man.
Yeah, right. You must have been doing a good job kept bringing you back.
Actually, at the canal station, the first thing I did when I reported aboard, have my first class muster the crew. I did one of these pacing in front of them while they stood at attention. And finally, I put them at parade rest. I said, is there anyone here that doesn't like it here? I said, I can get you a set of orders in the New York second. No one answered up. And I said, it's going to be my way. Because the place was a disaster. The station was a disaster. I don't know. I didn't know anything about the previous officer in charge. But my first impression was the crew was running the station. The chief wasn't.
Right.
So, anyways, my first class was the first one to go, bosun's mate. And I got a hell of a first class reported aboard. His name was, actually, all my leading petty officers were comic book characters. My first class bosun mate was William Buck Owens.
Okay.
My first class engineman or MK at the time was O.J. Rabbit.
Nice.
And my second class bosun mate was Steve Austin. I think he was Superman.
Yep.
Steve Austin. Yeah. But they were all comic book characters. I thought that was pretty funny.
Yeah, very cool.
But they were good leaders. Without them, it would have been hard to turn the unit around. But as it was, this would have been in 71. I took over the station in 1974, I think it was, just maybe before I got transferred back to Group Detroit. We received the Department of Transportation DePina Award. DePina was transportation and highway, what do you want to call them, in charge in Massachusetts. It was the highest award that the Department of we were under the Department of Transportation at the time. It was the highest award that any Department of Transportation could receive. And we were the first Coast Guard station to receive this award, and it was for exceptional duty as under the Department of Transportation. The award was presented to myself, and my XPO had a ceremony at Base Boston, and I don't remember the undersecretary's name at the time, but I believe Volpe was a Department of Transportation. He was head of the Department of Transportation in Washington. But we received the award, and Buck and I presented it to the crew for exceptional duties that, you know, we brought the station up to the best Department of Transportation unit in the Northeast region of the country.
Well, that's why you were hired on to become the cleanup crew for two more of them, right?
Well, I don't know, but
I mean, you can do a good job without just knocking it out of the park. No, that's awesome. What a compliment to your leadership at that. Receiving that.
There was two ways I looked at Bill. It was down as low as it could go, so the only way it could go was up.
Right.
And I got to tell you a 36-footer story here. It was, I want to say two or three days after we had this ceremony at the station. We had a little outing. And it was a couple of days later, the 36-footer, the unsinkable 36-footer, sank at the dock.
Oh, man.
So let me tell you how this went along. We got along fine with all the local fishermen. In fact, we worked together real close. About 6 o'clock in the morning, one of the fishermen were going out, and he seen the 36 sunk at the dock. So he docked his boat, come up to the station, and said, your 36-footer has sunk at the dock. It was down stern first. Bow, the forward turtle, was still up, and the stern was down. So they called me. I only lived 5 minutes from the station. I come running up there.
Were you freaking out a little bit?
Couldn't figure out how in the hell the boat sank. So anyways, I had him call. I had told the watchstander to call the group, tell them what was going on. And when I got to the station, the first class and myself went down to the dock. And the first thing I wanted to see was we kept the checkoff list in the binnacle. And after each watch, the watchstander went down and checked the boat. So the checkoff list was checked off. That the watchstander had been down there at the 0400 in the morning, and he checked the boat. Because it was the checkoff list was in the binnacle. It had a cover on it, and it was in there. That's where it was kept.
Right.
So the checkoff list was checked off. So after we got the boat up, one of the fishermen was a diver. He went down, hooked up some lines, and crane lifted her up. Got all the water out of her. There was nothing in the bilges, which was unreal. I didn't understand. We towed it over to the boathouse, hauled her up on the railways. The deck force cleaned up the boat, and the engineers did whatever flushing they had to do on the engine. The next morning, the group wanted us to bring the boat, if it floated, down to Woods Hole. So that meant transiting the Cape Cod Canal through Buzzards Bay and down through Woods Hole Passage. Well, we escorted it down with the 40. Never took on a drop of water. Never took on a drop of water. They hauled the boat down in Woods Hole. The stuffing box, no water came in through that. It was a mystery. Never found out why it sank. I mean, it went from the canal station, the east end of the canal, all the way down to Woods Hole, never took on a drop of water.
What do you think?
I never could figure it out, and nobody else could.
That's
but the
weird.
After turtle deck was underwater.
Huh.
So what happened, I never found out, and they did do some kind of an inquiry on it, in fact, I have a picture of it. Maybe I can fire it down to you sometime.
Yeah, for sure. That's a mystery right there. I was really hoping that you had an answer.
I don't, and no one ever gave me one.
Yeah.
So even if, sometimes fishing boats would come in there and they'd lay alongside of one of our boats and have their discharge hose over the side. But then again, I don't know how the water would have gotten into that aft turtle deck.
Right.
Because all the hatches were dogged.
Even the turtle hatch was dogged.
The after turtle and the forward and the engine compartment.
Huh. Where was all the water at? Whenever they pulled it out with the crane, I mean, how much water was coming out? Did they have to open anything that that had water in it?
We pump water out of the after turtle.
Yeah, so it was all in the turtle. But the hatch was dogged.
Yeah. The hatch was dogged.
Hmm.
And the only thing back there is the stuffing box. I mean, underneath that, I don't. it's a mystery.
Yeah, right. And right after you win the DOT award.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was
perfect timing. At least it happened after versus before. That's crazy.
Okay.
Let me ask you, too, so your final OIC tour, right? Your final officer in charge tour at Station Boston?
Yes, it was. After St. Clair Flats, again, I didn't relieve an officer in charge there. I never questioned it. I didn't ask why. There was only two people there, and they were more or less caretakers. It was wintertime. They were caretakers because the station was completely shut down, and there was a first class that was more or less in charge. Took over that station. It was a good station. Paul Sweeney was with me there, and Bill Heckendorn were both with me there. And after I left and come back to the first district to Newburyport, Mass, with the boating safety team, Bill and Paul, I guess, went to National or the lifeboat school out in, I don't know if it was it Humboldt Bay? Where was he?
Yeah, I think Humboldt Bay. Well, I know Darrow was there, so it could have been Humboldt Bay.
Okay, so that's where Paul was too, I think. Because I think, as I recall, O'Malley was 111 and Paul was 112. They both graduated at the same time from that school.
Right. That brings back a question on that one. So we talked a little bit about, you were talking about Engimen and BMs with an L after their rate.
Yes, that stood for lifeboat station. I don't know what the surfmen's have today, if they have a designation with their rate, like BM1 surfmen, or I don't know what they have today.
Yeah, nothing. It's just it's all one big happy family of bosun mates.
And they go from one bar station to another.
Based on the qualifications, I think, more than anything else. No designator though, other than the qualification.
Okay, so if you qualify as a coxswain at out there in the Pacific Northwest, you go from one SAR station to another.
Yeah, and these days you just never know. there's all kinds of crazy assignment opportunities and decisions that are made, so it's hard to tell where you might end up sometimes. But in general, surfmen, yeah, once they get a letter as a surfman, they'll stay at surf stations until they make that OIC jump, and then they'll typically do a smaller station, like Great Lakes Station, and come back.
Yeah. Well, it wouldn't be fair to take someone after they... Well, like myself, you know, all the time I spent ashore, even though I had an AIDS navigation background, it wouldn't have been fair to me to have gone on a 180 on a buoy tender.
Because you wouldn't have known anything, right?
I wouldn't have known a damn thing.
Yeah.
Or even going on a 311 or a 327, you know, in the weather patrol boats. I didn't get that experience. Although I wanted it at first, but then when I heard the sea stories, I said, I'm glad I'm ashore.
Well, did they have the so the saying these days is a well-rounded bosun mate, right? Because we don't have bosun mate lifesavers or anything else. Did they? I guess you guys didn't have that same impression back then, right? There was no such thing as a well-rounded bosun mate. You kind of found your community and stayed in it for the most part.
Well, you know, that's hard to say. I just went where my orders sent me. You know, I wanted sea duty at first, and then maybe after my first 10 years, you know, other than being on the Mackinac and the lightship, I didn't get any other sea duty.
Right.
So, I mean, that was no fault of my own. I was going where I was being sent, and, you know, it's... I wish I would have gotten more sea duty, but I didn't. So.
Right. So with the on the same vein as the lifesaver thing, I know you talked about being a provisional first class.
Right.
How did that work?
Well, if you were on a list, you know, for promotion, and that was you got paid, as I recall, for being first class. The chiefs were provisional. I don't know what they carried for a designator. The P for the lower rates stood for proficiency because you were on a list to be promoted.
Right. And then...
So you did get paid. Yes.
Okay.
It was called a proficiency pay.
So proficiency pay for anyone under chief, and then provisional above, or
for
when you
chief.
Made chief, right? Yeah.
Right, yeah.
And then how did the provisional work? Did you get paid as a chief, or did you get...
I was never a provisional. I made chief, I was chief. There was no P's after the BMC.
Okay.
They didn't have that when I made chief.
And what did the provisional mean, like, as far as if it wasn't the proficiency, but it was the provisional? What I mean, you just had to keep your nose clean for 6 months or something, and then you advance normally?
You know, Phil, that's a good question. I really don't know.
Yeah, I'm just curious.
You know what? I'll work on that and try and find out. I don't know who in the hell I would ask, so, I mean... We're going back to 50, 60 years.
Oh, yeah. Well, the reason I asked, right, is because I reading the history of how the Coast Guard advanced its people is very, it's confusing to me, you know, and it, even on paper, it's confusing. So I was just curious, somebody that lived it, if you had any insight, but it sounds like it was confusing no matter what.
It was. Yeah. Actually, we had so many designators at the time. You had AIDS navigation, then you had D1s and D2s, which was like a coxswain. There was just different, I don't know how to explain it. You had different designations for whatever. The most I remember is AIDS navigation, which was, I was a BM1 AN, and also when I made chief, I was BMC AN.
What's AN stand for? AIDS navigation?
AIDS navigation.
Okay. And then what else? Do you remember any others?
All I remember is they all started with a D, and there was like a D1, D2, and they stood for being qualified for small boats, like, you know, 44 or 36 or 40 boat.
Gotcha.
I just don't remember the designations back then. You know, I'll have to dig out one of my old DD-214s, because you got one every time you re-enlisted. And I think I seen it on one of my ODD 214s. I had the AIDS navigation, then I had a D something after that.
Yeah.
But again, I don't know what the hell it was. It
Yeah, fair enough. I was just curious. I got one more for you, that just since we're way back in there anyway. So the Coast Guard was under the Department of Treasury till 67. Did you notice a change between the Treasury and Transportation?
I did. It seemed like we got less money under Transportation.
Okay.
Yes. Than we did Treasury. I think the Treasury was a little smaller. We had ATF. Who else did we have in the Treasury? I can't remember
what other department.
Customs would have been.
Customs, yeah, I think Customs was Treasury at the time.
Firearm and tobacco.
Yep.
I don't know who else was, but it's actually the Coast Guard got what was left over. I mean, we never, I remember bumming rags off Navy ships, and we give them a gallon of gray paint. We just didn't have the money. We were never allocated the money. Actually, until they come under Homeland Security, now they're getting some money, and they're getting new cutters. Everything that we had when I was in was either built in the 30s or the early 40s. And some of those ships we had, they were seaplane tenders in the Navy, and they gave them to the Coast Guard.
Right.
We didn't have anything that was really modern. I'm trying to think of what were some of the modern ships that we got. But they were late in the 70s when we finally started getting new vessels.
Right.
And what we had prior to that was leftovers from the Navy, and that was it. I don't recall any new ships being built for the Coast Guard.
Yeah, and that's what I was curious, because they, I don't know if you've seen the news lately, but there were some rumblings of, you know, moving agencies around and stuff. And you always wonder where you're going to get the best deal, but it sounds like Homeland Security is probably the best deal for the Coast Guard.
Oh, yeah. And speaking of new ships, if I can mention this, there's a cutter in Key West right now. It's a fast response cutter, and it's those are all named after heroes.
Right.
And
enlisted heroes, too.
Right. And the one down in Key West is going to be named the Edgar Culberson. And that's going to be commissioned in Galveston, Texas. That's going to be your home port. Well, I grew up with Ed and Ferndale. We played ball together. Went to school. Grew up with them, basically. He joined the Coast Guard. There was three of us that joined. And out of the three, two of them were killed on active duty.
Oh, wow.
Edgar lost his life up in Duluth. We were pretty close. He lost his life. There was two brothers stranded out on the breakwall. There was a storm on Lake Superior. And three guys tethered themselves together, and they went out to try to rescue the boys as it was. They never found the boys, and Ed somehow got broke away from the other two and got washed off the jetty and lost his life. And this other fellow that I grew up with, actually, he was at St. Clair Flats. He was on a 30-footer. He was a boat coxswain, third class. And he was towing or trying to refloat a small cabin cruiser. And we had just gone to the nylon tow lines. Prior to that, we had Manila lines, tow lines. Actually, the Coast Guard was a towing service back in those days, too. But anyways,
how many feet were those Manila lines, those Manila tow lines?
How many
feet? Like, I mean, were they, you know, are we talking like 600, 900 feet of Manila tow line?
Oh, no. We didn't carry that much on the small boats. I can't recall, but there, it was, I would say, over 100 anyways.
Yeah.
But anyways, while he was trying to refloat this boat, naturally unbeknownst to the crew on the 30 boat, the cleat, it was about a 6-inch cleat, was held in place by, I guess, 3 or 4 wood screws. The cleat come loose and it shot back because the nylon line had a pretty good strain on it. It shot back and struck, his name was Gerald Yose. He was a BM3, and the cleat embedded into his back and killed him instantly.
God.
And he dropped. I can't remember who the MK was on there, the engineman, but he said, I think I broke my arm.
Oh.
And he just collapsed right there. Actually, it was shortly after that that the Coast Guard put out a boat call to put safety screens up. This was before we had the safety screens. But that's how those safety screens come about. It was after his death that the Coast Guard, anything engaged in towing, would have a safety screen. And they put them on the 40s, the 44s. I don't think the 36s had them. But then the 36s were pretty much out of service by then. But anything that towed had a safety screen.
Lessons written in blood.
Yeah. It was a hard lesson to learn, I guess. But
Are you going to go to the commissioning of the FRC?
Well, if I'm feeling well enough, I spoke to Edgar's wife. Well, she's remarried since, but I spoke with her, communicated with her, and she said I should be getting a formal invitation. So I haven't as of yet. It's supposed to be commissioned in May, and that may even be turned around with conditions we have right now.
Well, I hope both. I hope the conditions we have right now subside, and I hope that that you're feeling well enough to get down there.
Yeah, I hope so too. Because the last time I seen her name is Jill. The last time I seen her was in Charlevoix. Her parents owned a fish market and had a couple of fishing boats, and we used to buy all our seafood from her parents' store. But anyways,
I'll tell you what, that FRC will be that thing will be a fitting tribute too. Wait till you talk about new resources, new platforms. That's one of the best.
I didn't catch that, Phil. I don't know what happened there. I lost part of that.
Just saying that that the FRC, it's going to be a fitting tribute. Those are some of the best platforms I've ever seen the Coast Guard field.
On the naming of the cutters?
Yep. When you get down there and see it, I think you're going to be impressed.
Yeah. Well, I've seen photographs of it.
Yeah. I hope you get to step on board it.
Yeah.
May they let you go with the helm.
I was hoping she would have come up this way. It's my understanding that Boston's going to get 2 or 3 of them. I don't know when the heck they're going to put them. But that's the scuttlebutt I got, that they were going to, the next 3 or 4 that are going to be commissioned, they're going to be commissioned in Boston.
So. Yeah, I read a story. I think Boston's going to be one of the new home ports. They're trying to put a lot of light cutters together and, you know, just kind of major ports. So that'll be one of them.
Yeah, I know nothing about these. I don't even know how long are they.
154 feet. I'm telling you, you're going to be impressed. I really hope you get to step on one because it's going to blow your mind. You'll be like, wow, this is amazing.
Well, we get some nasty weather up here in the Northeast. Unless they're just going to be used for law enforcement, I don't know how far out they would send those.
I think we just got to test it. Right. We were talking about this here a couple episodes ago. There, as far as everybody knows, there are no operational limits on cutters. There's just the amount of fuel you can take, and from there, it's kind of up to the hull. Hopefully, it holds up.
Well, I know when I was a SAR coordinator down in Woods Hole, the 82s had a limit how far we would send them out. I don't know if I think the 95s did too, which I don't even know if we have any of those anymore. Does the Coast Guard have any more 82s?
Nope. 95s? 95s and 82s are gone. They got 87s and now the fast response cutters now.
Yeah, so all the ones they send over to Vietnam, all the 82s, they either left them there or what happened? I have no idea what happened.
I don't know what happened to it. I remember there was one in San Francisco when I was out there. I think it was still operational. It could have been they might have been using it for something else. But I'm pretty sure I remember an 82 because those were what class were they? What did they call them all? Were they point? They were point class.
Point Bonita.
Yep, that was. Yeah, they still had the point cutters. I think back as early as 2001.
Huh. Okay, because I haven't heard much about the that class, and I think the 95s were capes, right? Like the Cape Horn.
95s. They were before my time, Jim.
The 95s.
Yeah, I don't remember a 95.
Yeah, they were the Cape class.
Yeah, no, Cape Coral. We had Point and Island back in 01. Point and Island. So it was 110s and the 87 or 82s.
Huh. Okay, so the 95s then were before the 82s.
I think so.
Wow.
I was a boat guy though, so I can't. I mean, maybe they existed somewhere out there, but not in San Francisco Bay.
Okay, maybe they were East Coast boats, and because I know there was the Cape Horn was out of Gloucester, Mass, and I can't remember. We had three of them, and we had five of them in the first district. I can't remember all the names. I remember one, the Cape Horn.
I think if the first district gets some fast response cutters, you guys are going to be well protected. Those coasts will be well guarded, no doubt in my mind.
Yeah.
Well, Jim, we're sitting at about 1:20, and I know that I've got a list of stories here to ask you about. But I'll tell you what, let's we'll call it for this Easter Sunday, and thank our audience for listening. And we'll have you back on hopefully when I get Bill back in, so we can. We can tag team the rest of these. Sound like a plan?
It does, Phil. And I hope my memory was well enough to give you good information.
Hey, it was perfect, Jim. Jim, we much appreciate your service, and we very much appreciate you sharing your stories and your career with our audience today. A lot of the things that we talked about today are just not. They're not around anymore. You know what I mean? We don't have the light ships. We don't have guys standing duty at lighthouses. So interesting to hear.
Or in lookout towers at the SAR stations.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. A couple of them still man the lookout towers, but yeah, most of them are cameras now. You're totally right.
Yeah. All right, Phil. glad I could give you some good history of my career. There's still a lot more if you're interested or your listeners are interested. Be more than happy to pass it along.
For sure. We'll absolutely have you back on, Senior. And thank you for letting us call you back.
Okay, guy. So we'll be talking to you soon.
All right. Talk to you soon. Really appreciate it. Happy Easter to you and stay healthy, okay?
Okay. Thanks, Chief.
All right, Senior. Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org. That's CoastGuardFoundation.org to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooutcom or your favorite podcast platform and like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.